Hi, today is July 15th, 2018. This is MobileViews Podcast 261. I'm Todd Ogasawart, my good friend John Westfall. Spelled with two L's on the end. We were just talking about how to spell his name. And our good friend, Dorn... Don Sorcinelli.
That's the part of his name you screw up.
That's the hard part of your name. The Sorcinelli's easy.
That's what happens when you spend so much time focusing on the last name. The first name's the one that becomes the tough part.
Dorn Sorcinelli.
I kind of like it. You know, it's like Michael Dorn from Star Trek. Remember? Worf.
That'd be great when somebody mangles my last name. I'll say, no, you got that right, but you missed the first name.
Yeah, it's Dorn.
There's a silent R. So silent, it's not even in there. The opposite of a silent letter.
No, it's an invisible R. You just have to pronounce it.
It's silent and blind. You can't see it.
Yeah.
Silent and deadly.
Okay, we're going to lead off with the big news. I don't think Don or Dorn, I don't think Don's so interested in this one, but I know John and I were interested for years.
We were very interested for a considerable amount of time in this news.
Yeah, so Ming-Chi Kuo, the well-known prognosticator and supply chain analyst, is saying that there's a Mac Mini refresh that's in the queue after 3.5 years of nothingness. John and I have endlessly discussed why we want a new Mac Mini. Do you still want a new Mac Mini, John, at this point?
If it was this time last year, I really wanted one. My Mac Mini was getting ready to die. I didn't realize it, but it was on its way out. And I guess it was September or October of last year when my Mac Mini one day just literally died and never came back. And at that point is when I bought my QNAP NAS unit over here and redid all my network stuff at home. And so, yes, I would have been very interested in this a year ago when a Mac Mini was my home server.
Yeah.
Now, if it's really, really cheap, maybe I'm interested, but nothing with Apple is ever really, really cheap.
That's true.
It's not going to be like $199 or something for a Mac Mini. So I'm probably not as interested unless it's just really cool in some way.
Yeah. When I read that, I was kind of trying to figure out whether I'm still interested in a Mac Mini. My Mac Mini died years ago, but I have a 10-year-old. I think I have a 10-year-old iMac. Still running. Upgraded the RAM. It's still running fine. But it is 10 years old, and it's kind of time to let it retire, I think. So I've been interested in Mac Mini, but now maybe not so much. Maybe more likely to get a whatever new small MacBook, which is also rumored. So, if it's not too expensive.
I don't know about you guys, but anything that's 3.5 years between refreshes, anything that makes the time between Game of Thrones series seasons look short is, you got to wonder, it is funny though, both of you guys, when you talk about this, it is the, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, and I'm wondering if what you both are saying is pretty much what a lot of people are probably saying at this point after waiting this long.
And it's funny, if unless the product is an iPhone or maybe an iPad, if you're an Apple fanboy, your refresh cycle is very iffy. And even the iPads, which generally tend to get refreshed every year, the iPad Mini has not been refreshed in, what is it, John, 3 years now?
Yeah, that's the one that we also think is on its way out to near death.
Yeah. And as I keep telling John stopped using his iPad Mini a while back, I think. I still use mine every day.
Yeah.
This was when I went through the great iPad purge of 2017.
That was frightening.
And I sold my iPads and got a new iPad Pro. So
I don't know if you know this, Don, but John had like a cultural revolution of devices a while back, and he started using Windows again, and it was wild.
I know.
Well, and I do use Windows at work, so I'm on dual platform and all the crazy stuff, which ironically is my biggest frustration these days is finding a decent task management app like, To Do or Wunderlist or something like that that I like that's also cross-platform, because those tend to be Mac only if they're really nicely laid out.
Right. So go ahead, Don.
Can I ask? Yeah, when you mentioned that, John, how is Todoist on anything other than iOS? Is the Todoist app? Is there one for the Mac?
I think I've played with. I can't remember if I've ever played with Todoist. I've played with a number of them. Todoist was one. I think the app was okay, but it's the battle I always have is to-do apps either become ultra simplistic, mm-hmm. so it's no good if you need to say, don't show me this until this date, and you know, recur at mm-hmm. this interval and all that, or they're so complex that they look horrible. Like Todoist is one of those where it's got 10,000 features, yeah. but even with their most recent refresh, it looks like their UI designer is stuck in 2001. So I find this battle of features versus cross-platform. And in fact, the thing I'm using right now, and this is sort of sad in a way, is Outlook Tasks, because it's one of the few things I can do. But then again, it's sort of stuck in 2001. And Microsoft's own to-do app is not very useful, in my opinion. So... yeah, it's a continuing struggle.
Which is sad, since didn't Microsoft buy Wunderlist or something? Which is, I never used, but a lot of people I know liked it a lot.
And the idea is supposedly, you know, from what everybody says, the idea was that eventually Wunderlist, that team would be focusing and pivoting to use Microsoft To Do, which Microsoft To Do does integrate, at least for Office 365 customers at this point, with your Exchange tasks. That process has been slow and rather painful. I've tried Microsoft To Do as well. I'm actually a Todoist user, number one for the cross-platform, number two, consistency across cross-platform, which I tend to find that so many of these, never mind To-Do applications, just in general, when you move across platforms, you can tell feature sets just wildly vary from some developers, just because of where their focus is, where their money comes from. The other thing, too, about Todoist is they've got the Chrome extension. They've got it for Gmail. They've got it for Outlook, so that it integrates in well. But, it's To-Do. I tried Microsoft To Do a couple of times, and it's just – they'll get there, I'm guessing. Wunderlist is a pretty decent To-Do app. But Microsoft To Do is not there yet.
The nice thing about Microsoft To Do that I did find out about is that if you have an Office 365 subscription at work and at home, you can use Microsoft To Do with your home tasks as long as you've authenticated through a work.
Well, that's interesting.
Microsoft To Do account. Yeah.
Yep.
No, I haven't tried that. But at any rate. So John and I are now bitter Apple users because there's no new Mac Mini in 3.5 years, no new iPad Mini, and of course, Apple did away completely with the iPod Mini, and iPods in general, except for iPod Touch, I guess. So we're pretty bitter about this whole upgrade path.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah. but that said, although I would have to think hard about a Mac Mini, I would buy an iPad Mini Pro in a heartbeat if it had Apple Pencil support.
Yeah, I would do the same for that.
Okay, next up is something only affects... actually, Don might be affected by this. So Google's phone app for... I don't know if it's limited to the Pixel and the Nexus, but it can now prevent spam calls, which is kind of...
I believe they've released it for the Pixel devices first. Okay.
So I just learned about it reading an article in The Verge. And at first, I wasn't quite sure because it's always had a spam detection. This actually just automatically sends it to voicemail if you turn it on. So I rushed to my phone app and turned that sucker on because, you know what? I really don't care that my car warranty has expired, especially since I don't have a car warranty on my car. I haven't had one for years. I have an old car. And
that's how they get you.
Right.
You and don't of course, even know you have a warranty and it got expired.
That's right. And of course, you know, the whole tax fraud thing, that's frightening. What else? Oh, Windows support.
Yeah. And they're getting more sophisticated. We've been flooded And it's now it's starting to go into businesses as well, where they're doing the exchange, the area code and exchange spoofing.
Yeah.
To where they're spoofing your, and it's social engineering at its finest, hoping that if you see the exchange, you think, oh, it must be somebody I know.
Yeah.
Which personal phones, maybe, but they're doing it in businesses now, and I've witnessed it personally.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Don, since you're obviously tracking this. Do you notice here in Hawaii? You know, I noticed that if you look at the NXX for the phone number, so you know, and area code, right, exchange, and yep. then NXX. I tracked down the NXX prefixes to look at if there's a pattern, and they're almost all exclusively either T-Mobile, NXX numbers, or less frequently, but still. I can see the cluster level 3, which I didn't even know had phone note service. Mm-hmm. I noticed there are level 3 prefix NXX prefixes.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and you happen to hit the two that I know of.
Okay, so you're seeing the same pattern.
Yep. Okay. And it's interesting because from a business perspective, when you think about it, the only thing that I try to educate people on personally. I've noticed one consistent pattern is the caller ID. If they try to inject a name, it typically ends up being in all caps and somebody you wouldn't recognize.
Yeah.
So it looks a little bit strange on a lot of systems. The other thing I've noticed is if it's inter-office, like you're getting a call on your office phone and it's another one on the same extension, what I've noticed is they don't give... Whereas, depending on what you're using, if you're using, if you're using VoIP and you're using a sophisticated system, you'll typically get even inner office with exchanges. You'll get names, individual names. You get the company name that shows up. So there's little tells that make you say, "I'm going to let this go to voicemail and see if anything happens that way." But yeah, I've seen the frequency has been
way up.
Big. My cell phone gets. Several a day, it seems,
same
now,
here.
Lately.
So I'm really thrilled by this new feature on my
iPhone. Yeah, it's. I mean, I have to believe, Google's doing something. I have to believe everybody across the board between carriers and phone manufacturers should be doing more on this because they're only getting more sophisticated in how they're trying to how these spammers are trying to social engineer us into the ground with more sophistication, and something needs to be done to counteract it. It's getting a little out of hand.
For folks who are AT&T subscribers, cell phone subscribers, AT&T wireless, I should say, AT&T has a free app called Call Protect. I'm looking at it on my phone right now. That does something similar to this. So it'll block the call. It won't even send it to voicemail. It'll just block the call.
Yeah.
Either it's identified by AT&T or you can manually identify numbers as spam.
Yeah.
So, I should mention, John's already heard this story, but here in Hawaii, where we have a, not surprising large Asian population, we've been getting a lot of calls from, and it's a robocall. It's not even a person. We've been getting a lot of robocalls in Mandarin. And the message is, thank you, Google Translate. And the message is, they're saying they're from the Chinese embassy and that there's a package you need to pick up. And if you don't come, you'll be deported. If you don't call and pay money and, all that stuff. Anyway, it's big enough that it hit NPR had a story about it a couple of months ago. So here, I think Vancouver, Canada, and some other places where there's large Asian populations, specifically Chinese populations.
I mean, it is that they are getting more sophisticated, not only in the technology, but at who they're targeting with the technology and the way. I mean, you're starting to see some serious effort into, for lack of finding the story to tell based on that target that makes it. Somewhat, if not completely, convincing.
Okay.
So I have a question. How many spam calls on your personal cell phones do you get a week or a day?
Well,
how big is the problem for you guys?
Okay, so I'm looking at let's start with my iPhone. On the 15th, is that today? No, that's last month. So I haven't gotten one in a month. The last time I got a spam call on my iPhone, which is on AT&T, was June 16th. But that day, I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 10. I got 10 spam calls in one day.
Yeah, see, that's what I was going to say. It tends to happen in little spurts.
Yeah.
I'll get, and it's over the course, typically over the course of a few days, I'll get 2 to 3 a day.
Yeah.
And then I won't have, as a matter of fact, I was just looking, I'd have to go look at my other phone too, since I swapped the SIM to compare up. But I think it's been basically about, a little over a week since I've gotten one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I typically get, and I think that's the nature of, again, what's being attempted with these kind of things and robocalls and algorithms. But I'll get 2 to 3, maybe over a course of a couple of days, and there'll be a break, and then there'll be another set that'll come across.
On my Android phone, which is on Google Fi, I have got 2 days ago, I suppose. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I've gotten 6 spam calls in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah. And the interesting thing to me is the reason I asked is that what you guys have is not exactly what I have, and it's not exactly what my wife has. I get about 1 spam call a week.
Okay, it's not
too
bad.
And it's usually just 1 in that day. Maybe 2 in that day, but hardly ever. It's mostly just a one-off thing.
Yeah.
My wife gets 1 pretty much every other day at around the same time during midday.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting that they aren't just learning different ways to make it more believable or social engineer, but apparently even amongst those who send these things out, there's some debate about when to do it, how to do it.
Right.
And it always makes me wonder if the origin list of where you got the number in any way dictates
that's a good
how
point.
Often you target it.
Yeah. And the type of calling, like I said, when they're doing it based on when they're doing area code and exchange spoofing, I tend to find that my wife and I have the same. We got our phones at the same time, so we have the same area code, the same exchange. We tend to find that we get them in similar cycles.
Yeah.
So I think it's just the nature of what the implementation is. The other thing too is to keep in mind wherever you're at, depending on that location. My area code is for the greater Boston area. I'm sure there's just constant bombardment just because of the number of phones.
Yeah.
That it's probably just
a very dense area.
That tends to be a higher frequency at times of what they're trying to, figure a bigger target area. So,
by the way, in the same time period, I got those, whatever I just said, 7 spam calls on my Android phone. I got 1 human call. That was my sister, and it was an accident. Oh, sorry. I dialed the wrong number.
My brother, I don't want to talk to you. Wrong number.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really happy that this new feature is basically the way you do it. If you're an Android user that has the new phone app that supports this, you go into the phone app itself and hit settings, and there's a new feature that you can turn on that will auto route spam call, so that's awesome.
Yep.
Okay, the next one is a big topic that one of the reasons I wanted to ask some friends to join us, and Don was available and willing to join us today. Thank you, Don. Is the new Surface Go.
The unlucky friend that we got.
So Microsoft announced a new Surface, and basically it's a successor to, it's a successor to A, the Microsoft RT, because it comes running with Windows 10 S mode turned on, which means you can't run any app that's not S mode compatible and in the App Store, Microsoft's App Store, and be the more popular, not popular enough to have kept selling, was the Surface 3, which our friend Frank McPherson uses all the time. I don't know if he replaced it recently, but the Surface 3, with not Pro, right? Not Surface 3 Pro, but the Surface 3, which is an Intel device that runs full Windows 10. It's a real computer. The Go is a real computer too, but like I said, it comes with S mode turned on, and S mode is really confusing to me.
Right. So we're clear. It comes with S mode, but you can upgrade to at a minimum home for free. I'm not sure yet if you can do. I think there is a cost involved, and I also think depending on what buying channel, it'll also be available in Pro.
Yeah, I think you got to pay $50 or something.
Yeah,
like
there's
that.
There's a fee.
But the upgrade part is what confused because, okay, originally Windows 10 S, I thought, was a regular Windows edition. And then, like you said, you can upgrade it to Windows 10 Home Edition. Okay, that made sense to me. But yeah. Windows 10 S mode apparently means you already have Windows 10 Home Edition installed with yep. this S mode turned on, so you can only run apps that are S compatible yeah. from the App Store.
And the long-running question is, has it always been this way, which I don't think it has been, but at what point did it change? There's yeah. been ongoing long-term. But you're right. It basically, think of it as turning on the bits.
Yeah. So it's so like Windows RT, except you can go home.
Right. And when you think about it, what it really is it's when you look at what S mode is, you described yeah. it. Is there the need for a whole separate operating system when it's basically an on-off switch?
Right.
When you think about what it allows. So yeah, it's interesting. You're right. I think I like to immediately when I first heard this announcement, I thought to myself, this should have been called Surface. What we should have announced when we had our big education initiative last year. Because this, to me, is more along the lines. Now, granted, the other thing, too, keep in mind for differences, it's a 10-inch screen. So yeah. it's a little bit smaller. But, you know, price point and hardware-wise, and it, granted, it's in the guts are not high-end, obviously.
It's like it's a
but
Pentium.
The build quality, I haven't seen it yet, but I hear the build quality is Surface build quality, which yeah. is nice. You know,
Don, it's a Pentium. Know.
Well, no, okay, so here we go once again with Intel managing
awful branding.
Mangle and confuse the living tar out of us. With the, my understanding is it's supposed to be, and this is from a few different places where I've read and or heard, it's really closer to the, what was it, the Pentium, the Y series mobile chip. It's not an old, I hate that, you know, that's sort of like for how long were we still listening to them using, for what was our other Intel chip? Atom chips,
yeah.
which the M series, they were still referring to them as Atom. And of course, it had the legacy of the wonder that was the Atom chip
yeah,
in its early days. Yeah. But
yeah.
they're calling it Pentium Gold, but yeah. it's really supposed to be like the Y series. And so, yeah, it's definitely not high-powered. Yeah, you're not going to do your compilation, you know, your Visual Studio compiles on it. But it's one thing that everybody's been surprised about, but I'm not, is it's not running ARM. And I think the reason why is, probably until we get to the Qualcomm, was it the 850s that we're talking about, or even the thousands that models that we've just started hearing about, which is a little bit down the road. I figure that they wanted to probably play it a little bit safer and say this can run your Windows, you know, your typical Windows suite, whether it be that you're in S mode and just getting from the store, or if you want to run the more traditional apps. It's going to be interesting. I mean, everybody immediately said it's competitor X, you know, competes against this, it competes against that. I think it's just one more slot that, yeah, you can say they're competitors, but more importantly, it's a slot that they hadn't really addressed in a long time since the Surface 3. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, it's an improvement, but it allows them to, like I said, I'm just surprised, you know, I know I was listening to, what was it, Windows Weekly, mm-hmm. one of the more recent, yeah, and I thought it was interesting. They talked about the fact, which I still remember, that education event where education, and oh, by the way, here's this Surface laptop that costs an arm and a leg that nobody educated.
Right. But these things are cheaper, but they're not exactly cheap. The low-end model, which has 64 gigs of eMMC storage, not SSD, and 4 gigs of RAM is $399, and that's without a keyboard and without a stylus. And the 128-gigabyte version with 8 gigs of RAM, which is probably what most people would want, is $550.
Yeah.
So
I think what you have to do is sort of take a look at where the PC laptop market is right now. And for what, at that price point, you're typically getting maybe the processing power, but you're getting a lot of, for lack of a better term, second grade or lower grade build qualities for the hardware in terms of, you know, the box itself. And I think one of the things they're trying to push here is the, you know, up with everything else with the Surface brand, it's always been about, oh, the quality of the overall build, not just the components inside. You know, it's, $549. I've looked at a lot of computers that, they have the power, but when you really start to look at what, you know, a typical laptop that I would want in terms of lightweight, solid build and good reputation, you're paying closer to $1,000 these days regularly, you know, between $800 and $1,000. So I'm figuring that they're still counting on, it's not it may not be the highest end processor, but you're getting a really nice device for that price point. Do people latch on to it? Still yet to be seen. I think, you know, who knows? I think they're just at this point, they can check one more box that says, listen, you know, when you watch the, where they show you panning across all the different Surface devices, now they've got that last slot filled. You know, they pan to the last one. I'm like, okay, there's a little baby one that fills that little niche. But I, how well it sells, a lot of people are, you know, saying, oh, I want one. I'll wait and see in the long run how many units they sell.
Yeah, at first, my initial reaction, especially looking at the base model at $400, was, oh, I'm going to go buy one, you know, just to go play with it. But then it's like, wow, it's another $100 for a keyboard, unless you want the Alcantara keyboard, which is the one 130. So let's just say 100. So that's now we're up at $500 for the low end. Then, oh, it'd be nice to have a stylus too, since, you know, I don't have a personal stylus. I have one at work. But so that's another $100. Now we're talking $600 for the low end. And let's see, $550, $650, $750 for the higher end model. Without LTE, right? Because that model hasn't been released or isn't going to be released initially. So the Wi-Fi only, which is fine with me. I don't really need a...
I'll be curious. I think the big thing will be like what we found out with the first ARM computers is I'll wait, you know, be interesting in early next month. This to hear the first feedback on how it handles apps. You know, and again, keeping in mind that a 10-inch screen trying to run the regular Office is not necessarily the greatest thing in the world. What do you? The other thing at a 10-inch screen is what are your use cases? What are you going to use it for?
Yeah.
You know,
it's basically the same size as an iPad.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, at 10 inches, it's fine when you're running applications built for that dimension. Those screen dimensions, but as soon as you start to talk about that, your classic Windows apps. Now, the Office mobile apps, that, you know, hey, that may be 10 inches, because I can tell you that smaller than that, you know, with a phone, those Office mobile apps can work really well. It'll, it's going to be, that's what I'm really waiting to hear is how are the apps running and what are people, you know, now that they're literally sitting there with a 10-inch screen. What are they using it for, and are they happy doing it?
Yeah, the other thing is because it is, you know, 0.1 inch below the 10.1 inch cutoff for requiring you to pay for Microsoft Office, can you now use free version of Microsoft Office?
I think a lot of people are asking, and if I recall correctly, again, this one I'll attribute directly. I remember this from Windows Weekly was the question is still outstanding. You definitely, obviously, the Office mobile apps, because you're under the 10.1 are available, but the full one, the it had previously been said, I think it doesn't count to your 5 on your licensing.
Well, and that's something.
We'll have to wait. Apparently Microsoft's response was, let us look into that.
Let us figure out if we can cover that or if we want to charge you for it.
I as somebody who had one of the HP streams, the 8-inch. I had the 7-inch. I actually had the smaller one that was a. The problem wasn't whether or not I could run the Office apps. Mm. The problem was how usable were the Office apps if you didn't hook it up to an external. If you didn't hook it up to a monitor, and so that's I still say that's going to be the real telling tale is. Would you even want to try and run some of those apps? That's in some cases here more than a desktop. Here's more where I can see S making more sense, ironically, because the apps you get from the store are typically more oriented towards smaller screens.
Right.
So it's going to be fun to hear what people have to say about it. Like I said, I mean, I hope it does. I mean, that it does well enough to where Microsoft recognizes that's a form factor. I mean, we saw third party for a while push out some tablets, and then they went by the wayside. Let's see with a, and again, depending on how good the build quality is and what people say about it, I'll be curious to hear I'll be curious to see how it turns out.
Hey, John. So since you're a Surface Pro user at work now, you can considering getting the Surface Go for home.
Well, so this is what I've been thinking about this while you guys have been talking. My thought always comes back to who would actually buy this.
Yeah.
And so in the education market, people know Apple. And so if you're thinking, what do I buy? Apple comes to mind. And so I think they don't ever have to worry about if you're going to release a low-end device, right, will you have someone who's interested in purchasing it? On Microsoft's end, with kind of pushing the Surface as a more premium line, I worry that people who are already interested in Surface are going to think to themselves, huh, I want a premium device. I'm ready to spend premium money. Do I want to spend it on a device that, I don't know, just is the low end of premium? Or do I want something that's more higher powered? I mean, I'm thinking people who know things about computers look at stats and care about stats. People that don't know things about computers go buy a computer at Walmart. And to them, it's whatever color it comes in. If it's shiny or not shiny, I mean, that's really just about it. So I worry that every time Microsoft releases one of these bargain devices, because they aren't known for bargain anything, and Apple at least has been able to fool a lot of people into thinking that, you know, you education, you pay more, but you get Apple, and Apple is education. I don't think Microsoft really has a niche group there for the low end of any device. And I'm thinking if my Surface Pro, you know, if I switch jobs or something, or I get a different computer and I wanted a Surface, I'd go out and get a high powered Surface. One of
like
those,
the one you have now.
Like what I have now.
Yeah.
I would not be interested ever. You know, I was looking at MacBooks the other day and I'm thinking, you know, my MacBook's from 2015. I'm probably not going to upgrade again until 2020, 2021, something like that. And even then, I'm thinking, do I really want – I wouldn't get the low-end specs because in 2015, I got all the high-end specs, and that's why I'm planning on using this computer for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
So that's my big concern. Is it a decent product and does it work well? I think it's probably a decent product, and I think it probably works well. But I don't know how many people are going to be interested in buying it when they're looking at all the lineup for the Surface and going, huh, I could get one that's got more RAM, or I could get one that's got more – whatever I might be interested in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the other thing I'll be curious to see is back to when you mentioned education and back to the enterprise. Does Microsoft try to do anything to bundle this with Office 365 for education? Now, Microsoft 365, do they look at this as some sort of device that they throw in or offer at a big discount for those kind of deals too? I don't know. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, they've done it in the past, not too successfully, but not successfully for the overall line with Windows Phone, where they were throwing it into some of their deals. Do they do this? Do they do this to try and get their foot in on some education deals? Do they do this to try on some Microsoft 365? I've been wondering when they, you know, because we keep on hearing about Microsoft 365, the one component that's missing in the everything that's offered and included in that as a service is the piece of hardware. They're doing some leasing now, but they're really not tying it all in as a bundle. But I wouldn't it be interesting if that's what they do as a possibly a low end. And they do market this. They've already started marketing this for what do they call them? The frontline workers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you market this to say, okay, for enterprises, to say, okay, here's your Microsoft 365 for all your people doing inventory in the warehouse, where you've got line of business applications already written? You know, do they do something like that? I can't say, but I'd be curious to see if that's not one of the tracks that they try to take this on.
Yeah, Microsoft already has a Microsoft Pro leasing model. So you can already do that. I don't think it's part of Microsoft 365, though.
No, it's not yet. And that's what I'm waiting I've been waiting to see if sooner or later that they might do it with, you know, prior to this announcement, that they might do it with one of the Surface, you know, like the Surface Pro or something, where it is literally, here is one price per month for absolutely soup to nuts. Yeah.
I can't
the
see
hardware
it.
And the software.
I can't see it in the educational market anymore. I think Chromebooks got that sewn up these days.
I
just
do.
Easier to maintain in Windows. It's just way simpler.
Yeah. I think there's some traction at the administration level, ironically, for Office 365, even in education. But you're right. For where it falls apart is the whole big picture. I don't know of, I personally don't know in my area, they may exist, but I don't know of any school districts that are running anything other than Chromebook and they're using all Google services for education.
The interesting thing too is, which will make it harder for Microsoft to enter the market, is one of the arguments in, let's say, a year or two ago was, you know, the application side, right, where Chromebooks are just a browser, blah, blah, blah. But now that Chromebooks can run Android apps, and it will soon gain compartmentalized Linux software, that's going to, you know, we have containers of Linux apps. That's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah. And where it's going to be really interesting is Google making sure that they provide and this is a case where they better not pawn it off on third-party EMM providers. They need to, in education, the last thing education organizations need is to manage their Google for education pieces with the Chromebook and then have to turn around to a third-party EMM provider to make sure. My concern with this is that they run the risk of getting too complicated for their own good in education. John, we say it best. It's simplification that's really the big selling point. And in the past, I've seen when somebody starts to get a little, now we're going to suddenly get into app distribution, app restrictions, blacklisting, whitelisting, which you can't. Google better make sure it's kept easy and it's kept native and not try to pawn it off on third-party EMM providers. Because today, basically you get some simple, I will tell you, G Suite, you get some simple device management.
But that's because you don't need a lot.
Well, for Android.
No, I'm talking about Chromebooks.
I understand that. Today you don't.
Yeah.
But if you start adding Android apps.
Well, that's already there.
Containers.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm saying if you start to add that, now you need to provide a way of administering it.
Yeah.
To restrict it. I don't want all my students being able to install any Android app they want.
Yeah.
So again, you get back to the how do you control that? And the thing people don't realize, Android Enterprise today, as an example, not as the that it's exactly the same, but Android Enterprise today with G Suite, you get very little control. You're expected to go out and pay licensing for a third-party EMM provider to get real control. They run the risk of doing the same thing to education. They need to be careful in this regard, because I could very easily see, I can say, I know our school district, the first thing, if you're running Chromebooks, the first thing, and suddenly Chromebooks can start running Android apps, the first thing they're going to want if their school issued Chromebooks is, how do I stop this from happening?
Yeah.
Keep it in that one tool. You're okay. But if they start to get too sophisticated and say, oh, yeah, go talk to these guys if you want that.
Well, the problem for Windows, for Surface Go, assuming they want to use S mode as a limiting factor, it's going to be extremely limited because there's no applications of any use to most people in the Microsoft App Store.
No, it's back in education. You're talking about your Office apps, the mobile versions, which are all supported. And then there are some, again, it's back to line of business and a few other apps. But you're right. No, you won't. If you're running in S mode, it depends on who the organization is. If the organization is writing, and I'll be honest with you, most organizations still are behind. They're still working on everything other than UWP apps. They're still running, Win32. They're running classic desktop kind of apps. No, that not everybody's, obviously most haven't migrated anything over.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, the last thing I wanted to say about the surface go before we move on to our last topic, is that, you know, amongst our friends, we had a little private discussion in our mailing list group that, you know, other people have been talking about comparing the Surface Go to Chromebooks and to iPad, but Microsoft itself has not. Well, that's just changed because Wired has an interview with Panos Panay, and he directly addresses the question, do I think about Chromebooks? And he says, absolutely. And do I think about iPads? Absolutely. I think I use multiple devices, exhausting. And then he goes on to say why it's, you know, why he believes this is a better solution than iPads and Chromebooks. So that question of whether or not Microsoft is directly addressing Chromebooks and iPads is now moot. You know, the answer is yeah, they're thinking about it, and this is direct competition to it.
Well, gee, if Panos Panay said, oh, we're not thinking about that, I'd call him out on it in 2 seconds.
Right.
That's his job, to think about those things. That's sort of like telling him, that's sort of like asking the marketing guy, why do you think your product's better? Oh, I really don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. But I mean, it does address the question that we brought up internally is, you know, is this really going after Chromebooks and iPad? And there's like, well, they don't really say it. So I think
it's going after a slot. And yeah, like I said, that slot includes a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah.
I think it's here's the gap. Here's a piece that we don't have that addresses a whole bunch of different things.
Okay.
Does it compete directly against them? I don't think so. I think the Chromebooks beat them on price.
Okay, so does anybody who's bound and determined to go buy one? I almost was, but I'm not, I don't think.
I'm waiting to see. Again, yeah. I don't need it. It's something, if I don't need it, I'm not going to go run out.
Yeah.
I've reached that point.
Okay.
And at this,
so the last topic is one Don suggested, which I liked. And so I guess the question to frame it, Don, is what he had discussion in his office recently, I guess, is what old phone feature that no longer exists do you miss?
Yeah. So to give you some context to it, it's you know, there's a bunch of old hardware around, sort of the museum effect, you know, hanging around, and people always talk about, oh, you know, I miss, and it was funny, the conversation is always, I miss this thing generally, you know, I'll miss, and they were talking high level. So I was talking to a couple guys, and we got into the discussion on, I said, what about granular? Get like really fine. What is something from an old phone that you've used in the past, something specific? You can point it to a specific model, but rather than saying, oh, gee, I miss BlackBerry, or, you know, I said, oh, let's see if we can get, and it kind of got interesting because it made people think. And what was funny was right off the bat, I thought of one thing, and shortly, almost immediately thereafter, I thought of two very specific things. Let me start by saying one of them is I miss, and you guys will remember, probably a lot of listeners won't, but there was one device several years ago that's still my favorite small but good physical keyboard. Did either of you guys have the HTC Excalibur, T-Mobile branded it, the Dash?
Yes.
It
was like, yep. I still have
that little, that little chiclet keyboard was still one. I mean, I've used keyboards, physical keyboards, for so many devices over the years. That was the one that, and even with my meat hooks for hands, I was able to use. And I said, geez, I've never come across a keyboard since then that I really like, the physical keyboard on a device.
And
that was a great device in a lot of ways.
The Dash, if I recall correctly, was a direct competitor to the BlackBerry in design, mm-hmm, and form and function. And so for those of you thinking, oh, he's talking about one of those big clunky handheld PC type things. No, this is a tiny device. It's like a BlackBerry sized. It had no touchscreen at all.
It was smaller, actually. It was light. I would put it, if I wanted to make the closest comparison to a BlackBerry, think BlackBerry Curve, except think thinner than the BlackBerry Curve.
Yeah, it was really thin.
You know, and it was really lightweight, but the spacing on that little chiclet keyboard
was almost perfect.
Yeah, and it was one of those things. And it was funny because I said, you know, somebody was saying, well, you miss a physical keyboard. I said, not in general, but I miss that physical keyboard. If it was on a device today, I'd be kind of interested.
Yeah.
And I could really be efficient with it. The other thing was, and this will be funny, and maybe this is going back to being where I've sort of been sort of this minimalist kind of kick lately on, you know, big and complicated, you know, and one of them is large screens, small screens. I miss a form factor like, drumroll please, the iPhone, the 5C, a small phone that I could easily pocket. And especially now, I bet between going to the gym at times, being out and active, there are a lot of times where I miss. We've gone so far away from smaller size. You know, the smallest we see now typically is about a 5-inch, screen. And then you add, depending on the lack of bezel and things like that, all these things have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's great if I'm trying to watch TV or do certain things, but it'd be nice for on the go to have a smaller.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because, when the time came to replace my Nexus 6 Android phone, the choices were the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL. And the Pixel 2 XL, if you've seen, is gigantic, right? Yeah. It's almost like a small tablet. And so I wanted the Pixel 2 because, having already had a large Nexus 6 and the equally large iPhone 7 Plus, my left thumb had a hyperextension problem where it was physically painful at the joint.
Yeah.
Because I was not – I mean, there's ways to get around it, to use two hands and things. But let's face it, a lot of times you don't have two hands, and that's the whole point of having a phone,
It's partially about the UI and interacting with it, but also, like I said, I'm to the point now I can't put most phones in a pocket comfortably anymore.
Well, Don, all I can say is this. On the mainland, you guys have shirts – not all your shirts, but you guys have shirts with larger pockets than we do in Hawaii. For some reason, Aloha shirt manufacturers make these tiny miniature pockets – that are barely big enough for a phone of any size. So
I think you're being discriminatory. You're being a shirt pocket elitist.
Plus, you guys have jackets.
I wear cargo shorts, not because they're a fashion statement, but because they have bigger pockets in them that I can put things in. But back to the same thing. That 5C. There are a lot of times where I'd prefer a bigger device, but I've noticed, we have so totally moved away from the smaller, with the exception of the sudden retro move, Nokia releasing the 3310, the 8110. I don't need to go back that far. T9 text messaging has just never been my thing, and I hope it never will be again. But back to a smaller size device. I know a few people, never mind the folks, like I said, that want to be able to be more pocketable. I know a few people that, based on their hand size, using these larger devices is awkward.
Yep. John, your next take?
So thinking about the sizes, I haven't really thought too much about device size. But I do think a little bit about how I've been using devices more recently. And that has been the use of a smartwatch as well as my device. And for many situations, what I get from my smartwatch is why I would have wanted a smaller device. Something that was easy, that I didn't have to pull out, that wasn't huge. And what I've been doing lately, the most common, I have, a few different cases and a few different this and that. But what I've been doing most of the time with my iPhone is using a 12 South BookBook case, and it's my wallet. And so I can just carry this in my pocket, in my front pocket, like I would normally carry my wallet. I have my phone and everything in there. And then for 99% of the time where I would just need a quick glance, I can use my watch when it comes down to what's that notification, or I need a little bit of information that I know I'm going to look at. So, for example, I have an app that just shows – it's called Cheat Sheet, so it just shows a couple of numbers. So if I need a code to reference when I get to a door, just look on my watch and there it is. And I think that's sort of the only way you can get that happy medium today of – in the past, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I would have said, okay, today I'm going to be pulling my phone out a lot, so I'm going to take the SIM out and pop it into Microsoft smartphone instead of a pocket PC phone. Where I don't have the touch screen, I can just flip it open and look at it and then close it up.
It's funny you mentioned in showing that. I'll show these guys, obviously, in audio you can't see, but I actually have a case that is, for lack of a better term, it's like a pocket. It looks like a jeans pocket on the backside that I use occasionally if I've gone out, for example, gone out running, where I just put in a couple of pieces of ID. so that I don't have to take a wallet with me. Mm-hmm. You know, but you're right. I mean, it is again, to me, it's, we tend to carry so many things. And I remember when we were looking at devices a decade plus ago as our all-in-one convergence, and we kind of got there. It took us a long time, but now these devices can do a whole bunch of things. But at the same time, we went from trying to get them into small spaces to suddenly saying big is better. To a certain extent, yeah, they can do everything, but now they become the big clunky thing we have to carry around rather than, you know, two smaller things. So it's sort of a trade-off.
Okay, so yeah. But as far as feature goes, so to get back to what Don was saying about what feature would I want, I'm all about devices being smart enough to kind of know what I need them to do at any given time. And back, one of the first apps that I ever bought for a Windows mobile smartphone. So this goes back to 2002 or so when I first got into the platform, was a piece of software. I forget what it was. I think it was called Auto Mute or something like that. And it basically read my calendar. And if I was going into an appointment, it would mute my phone. And it was customizable. Location awareness was not a thing at that point because we didn't have GPS in our phones.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be, you know, do you only want to mute certain calendar type, you know, categories? Do you want to mute all events on a given day, et cetera, et cetera? And the reason I enjoyed that was because it harkened back to a feature that one of my friends had on a pager back in the 90s that was, during certain hours, just don't sound the alert. Just vibrate. Don't sound a tone. And it just is bizarre to me that we don't have that built in today, and that the closest we're going to get is iOS 12 letting you turn on Do Not Disturb mode and have it automatically turn off when your next appointment ends or when you leave a certain location.
Wasn't this supposed to be what assistants on phones were supposed to do?
Yeah, and then we got
it never
this,
happened. I know
yeah,
what you
we
mean.
Got into this stupid world where the assistant is giving you nonsense facts about whatever they think are important that day. And the stuff I actually would like you to do, assistant, like keep me from having my phone go off in the middle of an important meeting, you don't care to do that for me because you'd rather connect me with content when in reality I want you managing my device.
I'm looking at the
Do Not Disturb feature, and you're right. The current iPhone does not allow you to do that. I thought it did.
But the next version, when they demoed it in the
Pixel 2 next.
At the WWDC keynote, it was basically like, yeah, you'll just have to long press on it and then it'll do it. So it's a hidden Apple feature that most people aren't going to even realize is there. That might actually be one of the most useful features coming in iOS 12.
Not only will your assistant not be able to help you with that on the phone, we're not going to really show you how to do it yourself.
We're not even going to tell you it exists. So lots of luck.
Okay. So just as an FYI, for those of you who use an Android phone instead of an iPhone, there is, if you go to your phone app, you go into settings, you go into, sounds and vibrations, tap Do Not Disturb Preferences, and go look at event. If you turn it on, one of the options is during events for any calendar. So you can have it in a silence mode when you have a calendar event.
Any calendar
event.
In Google Calendar. You can't use third-party calendars. Like, you can't use the Outlook mobile app and have it happen.
Oh, my Google Home just decided I was interested in talking to it. Sorry, Google.
You should be talking to it. It's sad that you're not talking more.
Yeah.
This is one of the areas that absolutely frustrates me, that we at first it looked like we were going to have a lot of momentum with assistants and AI on phones to get more intelligent. And you're right, there are certain things you can do. As a matter of fact, the Android Do Not Disturb functionality is actually can be pretty sophisticated. You can do a lot to it, but there's no intuitiveness on the operating system side. It's all the user input that makes it
take me a while to find it after thinking about it.
When you're describing to me just now where it is, this is not a feature that apparently Google thinks is important to highlight in any way, shape, or form. It's buried in the middle of nowhere. So, yeah, I think one of the best lies that we've ever been told as technologists is that these smart assistants are supposed to do things for us that we would do ourselves, when in reality, they're just trying to connect us with more content for more content consumption and purchase and all of that, which is frustrating if you actually are going, why is Siri so dumb? Why is Alexa so dumb? It's because it's not in the best interest of the company to actually do those things that you want them to do.
Why in 2018 do none of the assistants, whether it be the Google Assistant or Siri, ever initiate a conversation from the phone based upon an event happening? People don't remember Cortana for all its shortcomings on a phone. If you had Bluetooth, if a text message would come in while you were driving, it would tell you, hey, you just got a text message from so-and-so. Do you want me to read it? Mm-hmm. How that still isn't in a modern phone when we talk about don't be distracted and go look at your phone. How we don't have events that trigger assistants to start a conversation. Well, we always are expected to start.
Apple CarPlay will do that if you have it in your car.
Okay.
So I think Google's that level. Drive thing will do that. And the only reason I know this is because I have an ancient car, so I don't even have a place to plug in my phone. Let me put it that way. But my daughter just got a new car, and she's got both CarPlay and Android whatever on it.
Ah.
So I was watching her play with it, and it's pretty darn smart. It'll let you know when you have a text message coming in while you're driving. And it'll even let you respond via voice and do speech to text, which is,
and
Windows Phone users could do that for a long time. So that's nothing new.
That was the one thing I kept on being amazed by before CarPlay, before Android Auto.
Yeah.
And I kept on saying, isn't this, you've got this integration with Bluetooth, you've got these use cases and scenarios, why aren't you doing it?
Yeah.
And I, to a certain extent, I think it'll be interesting to see as everybody pivots to the smart assistant at home, hopefully they think about those same things and asking themselves the question, do we carry that over to the mobile phone as well? Because it seems like the race right now, to a certain extent, is in the home market.
Yeah.
In terms of functionality and interactivity, we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Okay.
Well, the other odd thing about my features is that there you could actually, as a third-party programmer, program something up like this. In fact, there is one app on the App Store that's got pretty negative reviews because the programmer apparently doesn't really know how to program it, but it's theoretically possible today to silence even an iPhone with the hard switch. You can still do some things through APIs. You can read the calendar. You can find out when there are certain events. And if going back to Siri and the other assistants, you can at least push notification, on a situation with background sync. So a competent third-party programmer could write an app that would do all these things that we've just talked about, but apparently there's either no one thinking it's worth the time or no one that sees it as a viable market.
I think there's probably some folks out there banging their heads, some developers banging their heads on the wall because they probably thought, I get into this 2 years ago, but I got to believe with all the efforts that are being put into these assistants like Siri and the Google Assistant that if I write something, it's going to be obsolete because that's what they're talking about doing. We've been hearing about these assistants doing these things potentially for the longest time, and then they never got around to it.
The example I have for that is Workflow. Workflow app basically was exactly what Apple wanted in their long-term roadmap. And so once it got good, they just bought it.
Yeah.
And you look at the Siri shortcuts in iOS 12, it's Workflow.
Yeah.
It exactly is Workflow. They're still offering Workflow for free. But, if you want, you can build Siri shortcuts now that's the same engine. So there definitely is an incentive for a company to do it well, like the workflow team did, for someone to just snap you up and integrate you in.
Todd, what we didn't hear your feature that you missed. What feature?
I missed my headphone jack.
Well, that's better than what I was thinking. I thought the smart or the spot watch was going to come out.
No, that's not a feature. That's it. But I missed the headphone jack. I'll tell you why. True. There is nothing more reliable than a wired headphone.
Yep.
Just nothing.
Never mind that. Your wired headphone never runs out of power when you need it the most.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, in Hawaii, we have an extra problem. It's a first world problem, granted, but it's still a problem. If you want to get truly wireless earbuds, you know, like the AirPods, for example, with the exception of AirPods, which you can walk down to an Apple store and pick up, if you have an Apple store nearby, not all islands have an Apple store, we cannot have wireless earbuds shipped to this state because there are two lithium batteries, one for each ear versus one.
Mm-hmm.
And you are, and I did some checking, you apparently need, if you want to ship via air to Hawaii, one of the requirements is you, the manufacturer, have to guarantee that the battery that is being shipped in your device is at less than 30% charge. And, you know, that's a big expense to manually check batteries and, you know, draw them down to make sure they're below 30. And so they basically say, no, we're not shipping it to you.
Oh.
So we can't get wireless earbuds. We can get, you know, other ear. I haven't tried recently. There's a lot of stuff you can't buy in Hawaii. Amazon, for example.
I have Bluetooth headsets, and I've had, and they're great for if you do like I said, gym and jogging and things like that. But the fact that you constantly are worried around battery life, and you're right, there's times where, I mean, some of my devices that I still carry around have a headphone jack in them, and
show off.
I'm so happy they do for that reason, because there's been times where I'm like, oh, I need to plug in and have a private conversation.
Yeah.
I can on this device because it's got that little round hole that I plug this 3.5 millimeter thing into, and magic occurs.
Yeah. And, you know, unless you have a physically damaged headphone or earbuds, wired ones, it's going to work. You plug it in, you make a phone call. The sound will go to your ear, guaranteed. Bluetooth headsets, not so much guaranteed.
Well, and you know, it's funny. My oldest son still carries around an iPhone 6.
Yeah,
and actually a 6. I think it's a 6S. He had the opportunity to go to a 7, and he said no because he still wanted the option of having a headphone jack.
Yeah, a real headphone.
And you know, it's true. It seems, you know, we're like, oh, we're joking about it, but yeah, you're right. It's something a lot of people feel that way about.
You have to have the perfect storm for it to work the way Apple and the other OEMs want it to work. And I think about my own use scenario, I lucked into the perfect storm. I get to work and I want to listen to a podcast. I pull out my AirPods and I take the case out, and right there at my desk is a lightning cable for random charging of things. So I just plug in the case, and bam, I'm, you know, listening on my headset, and then as soon as I put them back in, it's fine. And if my, you know, phone starts to go out or my iPad starts to go out, I've got that lightning cable, et cetera, et cetera. But it's so easy to not have that scenario. It's okay, so easy that first thing in the day you're at the gym and there's not a lightning cable in your locker to plug in your AirPod charger.
So do you remember when we had to constantly recharge our phones because of battery life?
Yes.
And we were always worried about it. I'm that way in 2018 with my headset.
Yeah, so
it's like I come home at night and the first thing I do, even if it's got an 80% charge, is I plug it in because I don't want to take a chance.
Yeah.
So here's the other thing. It's not a feature I missed, but a feature I simply can't buy. Talking about, you know, John was talking about watches and things earlier. So one of the things that would be really nice to have is a portable Apple Watch charger, right? You know, an inductive charger. I mean, all Apple Watch chargers are inductive, but a battery-powered inductive charger. So you're on an airplane, you're in a car, whatever, you know, on a long trip. Just charge your phone while you're moving.
I thought I saw something.
There are. Yeah, the problem is we can't get
third party. Oh, you can't. That's right. We're back to the same thing.
We're back to the battery problem.
Has anybody looked into Amazon possibly getting high speed hovercraft to make runs from?
I'm hoping that they start stocking those things in Whole Foods because we do have one of those nearby.
Oh, yeah. Have you thought about having more friends that would just send you things through, you know, kind of on the down low? Because, you know, I'm looking at this portable wireless Apple Watch magnetic charger that's pocket size that, you know, I'm thinking of putting up a shared
spreadsheet, and all you guys who are coming, or gals who are coming to Hawaii in the near future, I will tag you and say, okay, can I have this shipped to your house before you leave? And can you drop it off for me when you come to Hawaii?
No, we'll just put it in another box and say it's something like perishable, highly contagious fruit. There's a better chance of making it to you guys at this point.
I mean, I'll tell you, Todd, if you buy me one of these things too, because they're pretty nice, $136.99, I will take the one for you and I will charge it down to below 50%. And then I'll throw it in a box and send it right over to you. No problem.
For the low price of $36.99, I will drink the battery.
Yeah. That's the other thing I miss. Replaceable batteries.
Yeah.
Right? Remember the days when, because we had the problem with, you know, charge capacities were not as good as they are now.
Yeah.
You know, there's sometimes, we have external batteries and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? A thin, small, second spare battery is so nice.
And phone chargers that had a second slot for the recharge, so you could charge the phone and the battery, second battery as well. Oh, I missed them.
So, you know, yes, we needed a second battery desperately in the old days, and it was good we had it. And now it's not as desperate, I have to say.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll tell you something funny. So, you know, when I charge my, I still have a separate Fitbit, even though I have an iPhone and stuff, and a watch. But I really love my Fitbit. Fitbit One, as for you guys who remember the little doohickey that is no longer available for sale, by the way.
Right.
So when I charge that, I have to unplug the little plug I have in my multi-charger for my Android phone. And so the other night, I charged up my Fitbit, and I took out the Fitbit charging plug and put it away so I don't lose it. And I forgot to put in the cable for my phone, but I plugged in my phone, not remembering that part, that it wasn't actually connected to anything on the side. So I didn't actually charge my phone overnight. And the next day, I noticed, hey, my phone's kind of low, you know? I was like, I don't know, 50% at the end of the workday. And I dutifully plugged it in. Next morning, my phone was at like 7% or 10% battery because I had not charged it for 2 days. But the good news was I hadn't charged it for 2 days and still had power, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. You know, this is a Nexus 2 in this case, which does not have a large battery to begin with.
Yeah. No. Yeah. We've come a long way. Yeah. You know, and two, I think we're still at the. I remember a lot of years ago, we'd say, well, the first thing is, what are you running on your phone? Why the, you know, it's draining fast. What are you doing?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, it's 2018 and it's still the same way.
Yeah.
I can bring any phone to its knees with a few apps, you know, that especially on, you know, when you talk about Android, where you still have even, you know, the architecture is better than it used to be when better now with push notifications and the likes versus having to sit there and pull in the background. But I can still, I mean, it's anything, anything with any kind of battery life beyond a few minutes. And that's one of the problems back to those headsets, you know, to make them small and lightweight, you're not going to get a lot of, I actually have a pair now that I use, a headset that I can get about, I'd say probably about 3.5 hours, maybe 4 hours out of a single charge. Which lasts me multiple workout sessions, you know, for several days. I only know that because I decided to, you know, play roulette, Russian roulette with it and see how many days I could go. You know, it's like driving a car on empty. But I did that just to see, but yeah, I still end up recharging them frequently because I don't want to risk it. And it's, you know, it's painful.
All right. So the last thing I wanted to mention, I did not have in the show notes, but it just occurred to me, is even though tomorrow is the 16th, not a prime number, Amazon Prime Day actually starts tomorrow.
Yeah.
At, I think, 3 p.m. Eastern. So I have a couple of things on my wish list. I'm going to see if they that goes down in price tomorrow and ordered if it does so.
Anyway. I refer to this as National Willpower Day or International
Willpower Day. So I hope everybody has a happy, well, I guess it depends when your fiscal year starts. Our fiscal year started in July, so happy new fiscal year for those of you who do it in July. And happy Prime Day tomorrow for those of you who are Amazon shoppers. And thanks to Don for joining us, or Dorn, for joining us on this on this podcast. Dorn.
I got to go out and change my name legally. I'll have to figure out what papers are for all that.
I mean, this is how we are going to take over the world, Dorn. I'll just change my name to Jorn.
Yeah. And, of course, I guess I'm torn. But, anyway. all right. Okay, so that's it. Movies Podcast 261. Thanks, as usual, to John. Thank you to our special guest panelist, Don. And I do not have a name that ends at an N, so sorry about that. But we will talk to you next time.